This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Listeners to our radio show know that we present it each week in three segments. And as we reach the year's end, we sometimes look back on the big stories by arranging them by theme, obviously three themes. Reviewing 2022, we're calling the first one Everything is War. We've often commented on the overuse of the word.
This administration declares unconditional war on poverty.
Our new attorney general will be directed to launch a war against organized crime in this country.
There is a religious war going on in this country.
The war on drugs will be hard won, neighborhood by neighborhood.
Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there.
Today we reached a historic milestone in our war against the coronavirus.
But in the last couple of years, we've seen a notable shift in the use of the word.
The New York Times and The New Yorker are now running headlines saying, is a civil war ahead? Our political literature is experiencing a sudden surge of consideration of the possibility of the next civil war.
We are closer to civil war than any of us would like to believe.
Last January, as the first anniversary of the January 6th attack on the Capitol erupted and receded, we asked David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker, was the invoking of war, that war, just another overreach?
We conjure visions of probably the worst moment in American history, or at least on American soil, in the 1860s, pitched battles and 25,000 people dying in an afternoon. But that's not the kind of civil war anybody should be thinking about. The phrase is meant to evoke a sense of sporadic, unpredictable, but highly destabilizing moments of violence that we've already seen examples of. In the modern sense, in Oklahoma City, at the U.S. Capitol, plots to kidnap the governor of Michigan. So I think that there are many kinds of journalism, and one kind of journalism is the journalism of warning, that if we ignore it, it's far worse.
But have you ever jumped on board a bandwagon of horror only to find out it was overhyped? I mean, with so much misery and fear in the world, sometimes I fear that pulling that lever is just too easy. I feel the need to do a lot of self-interrogation before proceeding.
Well, I'd remind you of the late 80s. A scientist named James Hansen came before Congress, and he said, we are witnessing the perilous condition that we now call climate change or climate emergency. And if we had listened more carefully in the late 80s, when it was easier to fix this problem, we would not be here in 2022 completely consumed with very legitimate anxiety about the very state of our world. When I'm too sanguine or calm as a journalist, that can lead to a kind of complacency. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at the country's experience in 2003. The journalism as a whole, I'm not saying all of it, but as a whole, was not aggressive enough.
In the run-up to the war?
Absolutely. I plead guilty to that. To this day, mm-hmm. It's a torture not to have been able to punch an adequate hole through the Bush administration's case for war. And the consequences were horrific.
So let's say there's nothing to be lost by sounding the alarm of civil war. Mm. What do we gain?
A former president of the United States who is going to run for president again and who shows nothing but love and support for the most violent and/or deluded political actors in the country. If the metaphor, if that's what it is, of civil war makes us pay attention, I think it's legitimate because the facts bear it out. To make us pay attention, that to me is not only a legitimate activity, it's a necessary one.
not to succumb to a lack of imagination.
Or not to succumb to the very human desire to look away.
That was David Remnick in January. In December, Atlantic writer Adam Serwer said that the phrase suggests this era we're in is particularly violent, and actually it's not. In fact, he argues, nowadays political violence is very much out of favor.
You can sort of see this in the characterization of the Capitol riot. Right after it happened, Fox News was saying, well, it wasn't conservatives who did this, it was Antifa. And obviously they switched messaging when Donald Trump tried to say that the Capitol riot was a good thing. The fact that they wanted to attribute it to the other side is a testament to the idea that political violence is much more unpopular than it was back in the day. Now, I think there is certainly a tremendous amount of verbal advocacy for political violence. After the FBI searched Mar-a-Lago and repossessed those classified documents, you saw Donald Trump warning of civil war and sort of people on social media talking like a lower level functionary on the Death Star about what they were going to do.
We've heard Tucker Carlson talking about Biden taking actions that have effectively declared war on half of America's citizens.
This is a strategy for engagement and branding. These people are trying to find an audience by catastrophizing, and it's mostly hot air. There's a small number of people who are willing to engage in violence on behalf of these causes, and those people are dangerous. But when you think about civil war, I mean, that is a level of violence that is on, you know, it's another order of magnitude.
But the year was filled with literal war, too, one that grabbed the focus of the government and the media for reasons both geopolitical and perhaps romantic, in the dictionary sense of being marked by, quote, the appeal of what is idealized, heroic, or adventurous. Russia's invasion of Ukraine last March was by no means a metaphor. It was and is a war of devastation, but it was preceded by a war of information. We tracked the ever-changing array of Kremlin narratives. It was a war against Nazis, a war of liberation, a war against NATO, against Western aggression, against moral corruption, a war to preserve and protect the Russian way of life. Russia's information war also entailed the dispersal and decimation of Russia's free press. When Alexei Kovalyov's news outlet Medusa was classified as a foreign agent, increasing the chance of his arrest, he was forced to flee Moscow, joining countless journalists from across the globe.
I want you to just grasp this full severity of this. The New York Times kept reporting from Moscow throughout the entire 20th century, throughout two revolutions, two wars, in the untold number of, you know, social and political upheaval. Now they're leaving because they cannot guarantee the safety of their staff anymore. So Medusa would be one of the few, if not the only one, who delivers the unfiltered, uncensored news. We've been anticipating this for many years, founded this publication outside of Russia to protect ourselves from physical harassment, from getting our office raided. But we will continue working because, well, the whole responsibility falls on us now.
10 months later, Ukraine still staves off Russia's attacks and has even recovered some territory in the east and the south.
I think the messaging has been pretty consistent, and that message is we will not let the aggressor take our land without a fight.
Olga Tokariuk is a Ukrainian journalist. 6 months after the invasion, she told me about how those invaded have used the media to enrapture the world.
There, the message was, this is not just Ukraine's fight. Ukraine is fighting for the values of freedom and democracy.
I was thinking about those selfie videos that President Zelensky posted early in the invasion. Those videos were engaged to great effect, not only with his own people, but with the world. How about now? Do they still work?
Yeah, you know, I remember in the very first days after the Russian full-scale invasion began, me and other people whom we were sheltering in our house, internally displaced people from different parts of Ukraine, were sitting in the basement during an air raid alert and watching to these videos of President Zelensky. And they were giving us a really strong morale boost to see that the president of the country is here. He's in Kyiv. Me personally, I'm not watching them as often as I used to. But somehow it feels comforting, you know, to receive notifications that a new video from President Zelensky has dropped.
Still, war fatigue is inevitable if it's not your war. And when competing wars, especially domestic metaphorical ones, flare up. This year, free speech was a major battlefield, and Joe Rogan was a phoenix rising unscathed from the flames after being hailed as a martyr for spreading COVID misinformation on his hugely popular podcast on Spotify, prompting some big artists to quit the platform. Also, Rogan was pretty insensitive, used the N-word a lot, and anyway, Spotify gave him a public slap on the wrist, and he agreed to remove about 70 episodes.
A lot of this is a question of scale. Who is spreading the misinformation? How many people are they reaching? Because he's not just a random podcaster, right?
We spoke to CNN columnist Jill Filipovic back in February.
Whether Joe Rogan wants to admit it or not, he is considered by a tremendous number of people in the U.S. and abroad somebody who they can trust. And when Spotify makes a financial agreement with him to, on Spotify's part, financially benefit from that broad social trust and these claims of, you know, expertise among the guests, then Spotify assumes a set of obligations that they're not meeting here.
Rogan himself has said he shouldn't be taken seriously about COVID information.
I'm not a doctor. I'm a moron. And I'm a cage fighting commentator who's a dirty stand-up comedian who just told you I'm drunk most of the time. And I do testosterone and I smoke a lot of weed. But I'm not a respected source of information, even for me. If right. I say things, I'm always going, check on that, Jamie. I don't know if that's true.
Right.
I do that all the time.
Right.
But I at least try to be honest about what I'm saying.
I mean, how can you not forgive a guy who's that authentic?
You know, what I hear in that clip is kind of wanting it both ways. Wanting to be taken seriously by his audience as someone who tells the truth, right? Which he's emphasizing. I ask Jamie to Google that for me.
After he said it.
Right, exactly. But also if I get it wrong, I'm an idiot. So, you know, you can't rely on me for anything. And it's like, well, you kind of don't get to have both of those things. Audiences understand that artists and creatives play with the facts, which is par for the course for, you know, rock stars, for musicians since forever. I think that we do expect something different from people who play this kind of quasi-journalistic host role, mm-hmm. which I think is a fair way to characterize what Rogan does.
Rogan's show is still huge and he's still rich, his free speech intact, as usually happens. It was a good year for hearing rich guys grouse about the danger to our First Amendment rights, like Elon Musk.
Twitter has become kind of the de facto town square. It's just really important that people have both the reality and the perception that they are able to speak freely within the bounds of the law.
Last week, Elon Musk banned high-profile journalists from Twitter.
Musk first suspended the account that tweeted the whereabouts of his jet, and then the accounts of 9 journalists who reported on it.
Musk reversed the suspensions after tweeting out a poll. 58% of more than 3.6 million voters said the accounts should be unsuspended now.
It's worth noting this was the second poll Musk posted on this topic. He said that the first had too many options, so he narrowed it down.
Musk then tweeted a poll asking if he should step down as CEO. Of the more than 17.5 million people who responded, 57.5% said yes. He said he'd step down when he found a replacement. It seems most people don't like when Godzilla rampages through what they regard as their own communities.
Right. And we've seen that as part of his rush to get costs down, Musk has fired half of the company.
I spoke with Thomson Reuters Foundation reporter Avi Asher Shapiro in November, who told me that those cuts were having an even greater impact outside the U.S.
So we've seen reports that 90% of the staff in India were fired. The entire Africa hub in Ghana was fired overnight. Twitter doesn't need someone there to run its servers and allow people to use the platform. But if they don't have local staff, if they don't have local content moderators who speak the language, if they don't have people who specialize in managing these relationships with tough governments, if they don't have people whose job it is to be in touch with civil society groups who have their ear to the ground, you know, they're going to be operating blind. And that can be a big problem.
We've seen a lot of people worrying whether Twitter will even continue to exist. What happens if it doesn't? What happens to the activists and activism that relies on it?
Look, it's really hard to know, but the ability for the world's richest man to buy the rails and wires of such a massive communications apparatus and then unilaterally make changes to it, I think, is an important reminder of what it means for our communications infrastructure to be, you know, up for sale to the highest bidder, which it is. You know, these are private institutions.
But they function often like public utilities.
Yeah, and the Musk thing is a great inflection point for people to think about that. I mean, Elon Musk can shut it down tomorrow. He could take everyone's direct messages. He could publish them on the internet. He could give a list of all the users in Saudi Arabia. He could give them directly to the state. He can do whatever he wants.
The battle over what content we should moderate, what platforms should permit, like many of the other wars in 2022, rages on with no sign of slowing. But the war over free speech was just one prong in the culture wars. 2021 was the deadliest year for trans people in the United States, and 2022 was the worst year on record for anti-trans legislation. Among the vocally prominent proponents of those is Colorado Rep. Lauren Boebert, who has said that merely allowing children to identify as transgender is grooming them. Last month, in the wake of the mass shooting at Club Q in Colorado Springs, she said it was disgusting to blame her for what happened, or to say she had, quote, bad rhetoric about the LGBT community.
I think that some people, especially living in larger cities, think that trans people would be safer because we have so much more visibility.
In November, I discussed the growing threats to trans and LGBTQ plus people with Joe Yerkaba, a reporter for NBC Out.
There are actors like Laverne Cox, Elliot Page, openly trans people who have a lot of visibility. But in response to that, there's been a significant pushback from the far right after marriage equality, who think that LGBTQ rights has kind of gone too far.
Yerkaba said that the most extreme narratives, the ones that warn of threats to the children and to the culture, are no longer confined to extremist news outlets.
A report cited that Lauren Boebert, along with 9 other politicians, are driving rhetoric that labels LGBTQ plus people as grooming children. So it's coming from these people who have national platforms, and then the media is reporting on that, and so their messages are getting spread that way.
One defense of any culture war is that it's inevitably, invariably, all about the children, protecting the children. Last spring, we spoke to New Republic staff writer Melissa Gira Grant.
It's such a pernicious and kind of old-fashioned, in a way, claim to make about gender and sexuality, right?
This evil that we're facing is grooming young children for sexual abuse.
When did our public schools, any schools, become what are essentially grooming centers for gender identity radicals?
Sounds really scary to be told that if you stand up for LGBTQ rights, if you stand up for your trans students, your trans kids, you essentially are saying child abuse is okay.
In none of this do I mean to imply that there's nothing to discuss about our rapidly changing America or the pace of that change. It's just that there is so little real discussion, so little empathy, just fear and rage and combat in a metaphorical war that claims flesh and blood casualties. Thus ends the segment we call Everything is War. Up next, Everything is Fiction. This is On the Media.